Welcome back to another edition of the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Lovino. And this week, as always, I'm joined by my colleagues at FrontStretch.com, Mike Neff and Zach Catanzaretti, as well as Chase Briscoe, who won the Xfinity Series race this past weekend at the Roval at Charlotte Motor Speedway. But before we get started, I wanted to remind you on how you can sign up for the podcast every single week. Subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on iTunes, and you'll get it sent to your smartphone once it's published. And once you do, be sure to stop by iTunes and leave us a review, as 5-star ratings helps us out tremendously. So, Chase, big weekend for you, winning the inaugural race at the Roval in the Xfinity Series. We're a few days out now, so has it kind of sunk in that, you know, you've been victorious in the Xfinity Series?
Honestly, no, not yet. You know, I felt like we could go run up front and compete for, you know, wins and whatnot, but never in a million years did I think, you know, it'd come at the Roval. That's probably been one of the last places I would ever get. So, definitely pretty cool to get our first win and do it at the Roval and be the first guy to win at the Roval.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it was your fourth race in the 98 car, and a strategy played a little bit into the win, getting the track position in the second and final stage. But when did you realize you had a race-winning car?
Yeah, you know, all weekend, we always had really good long-run speed. We just didn't necessarily have the short-run speed. I just wasn't very good. As a driver on my end, it took me, you know, really till Saturday to figure the place out. Going into qualifying, I felt like we probably should have qualified about fourth, and I just messed up in the final round and kind of cost us some track position. But like you said earlier, my crew chief did a really good job of, you know, in our position, we didn't have to race for points or anything, so we could short pit every single stage, and it gave us a track position. And I knew when we were able to hold off Hemric when we both had equal tires at the beginning of the final stage, I knew we must be pretty good, but I didn't realize we were going to be as good as we were all the way to the end.
And you mentioned how you didn't think, you know, your first one would come at the Roval, but throughout your career, you've kind of been okay, so-so on road courses in trucks and cup. But you were surprised that your first one came at a road course?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was just excited to lead a lap at the Roval. I thought that was pretty cool to lead a lap on a road course. And, you know, I was just waiting once I finally led the first lap at the Roval that weekend for, you know, him or to run me back by and blow by me. And we just kind of maintained our gap, and like I said, just to win at a road course is something I never in a million years would have thought would happen. So, pretty special to be able to do it at the Roval, too. I mean, obviously, any road course win would be cool, but to be able to say you're the first guy to do it at the Roval is pretty special.
Zach, you got anything?
Yeah, I mean, I know Chase and Zach at hands already. I know it's kind of been tough seeing what track suits you best. I mean, we've seen you win on three completely different types of tracks, from Homestead last year to Eldora, now a Roval. I mean, do you really know what type of racing suits you best? I mean, obviously you come from a dirt racing background, but was Saturday's performance really surprising to you, or do you kind of find yourself as a kind of an all-around type of driver?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think of myself definitely as somebody that's versatile. You know, if you look at my three wins, they, like you said, they are all, you know, really different. For sure, it kind of shows versatility, but the one thing they do all have in common is just they're all low grip. You know, obviously Eldora, you have no grip. Homestead, after a couple laps, you're sliding around a lot. And then the Roval, we were sliding around a lot. So anywhere that's typically low grip and the car's sliding around a lot, I feel like is normally when that's my best racetrack. And I kind of, not necessarily struggle, but it's hard for me to find an advantage at places that we go that are really high grip. For example, like a Kentucky or a Texas or somewhere that's been repaved. So I feel like anywhere that's low grip, I would typically run better in places where you can kind of move around the racetrack and find some grip.
Yeah, and for you, winning in this 98 car, I mean, we've seen you in the 60, and we know how much winning Roush has done in past years, but for this team, they haven't won nearly as many races. So when it came to giving this team a win, for this year, I mean, how big a part did that play and how special that win was?
Yeah, it was certainly special to, you know, just get a drive for my hero, Tony Stewart. Was a privilege and an honor, and to be able to say that I won under the Stewart Haas banner and for the Biagis and the Mid-Besties in the 98 car is really special. Just to be, you know, with the likes of Kevin Harvick. I mean, Harvick won in that car earlier in the year, and then obviously the other one at the Roval. It's pretty cool to have my name in the same list as him. So we got one more race left in the 98. It's at Kansas, and that's one of those places where you can move around all over the racetrack and run right by the fence, and that's typically when I run good is places like that. So I'm really excited to go to Kansas. I honestly feel like we can go there and win too. So that's going to be the goal, and hopefully we can do it.
And Chase, I know you've ran IMSA a lot this year, a few times. We talked about that at Bristol in August. And like I mentioned earlier, you've had decent runs on the road course, but you also mentioned in Victory Lane on Saturday that you felt like your dirt experience helped you quite a bit. Why is that?
Yeah, I think, the dirt experience just helped out. Just for one, it was really low grip, especially in the infield. You were sliding around a lot. You didn't have a lot of grip on the exit of the corner, so you had to be really smooth with the throttle, and you just had too much power for what you needed. So, in that way, dirt definitely kind of came into play. But the other thing was just, coming into the Roval, nobody knew what to expect. Nobody knew the right line to run on the racetrack or anything like that. And it kind of was like a dirt track where you had to search and find the racetrack, and you could move around because there wasn't necessarily a favored groove that everybody knew you had to run. So there were different little things you could try in each corner to try to make up speed. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. So I feel like just having that dirt experience is obviously sliding around, but then at the same time, just constantly searching, trying to find speed definitely helped.
We've seen a few drivers that have been ARCA champions that don't really get a shot, and others that have been almost fast-tracked to the cup level. For you, how has the ARCA championship transferred into opportunities at the NASCAR level?
Yeah, first off, if it wasn't for ARCA, I don't think anybody would really know who I am at this level. The ARCA was really the perfect place for me to be able to, first off, get a chance in a stock car, thanks to, the Cunninghams, but then be able to race at racetracks that put me on the same platform, I guess, as the NASCAR guys, running to places like Pocono and Kansas and Chicago, and being able to, win races at those places in front of NASCAR people. So, ARCA's just a great place, I thought, to not only learn how to drive a stock car, but to race on these tracks that you don't really get to go to very often, and be on a national platform where, there is guys developing, and, the teams look and watch the races, and I just thought it was a perfect place, and I couldn't imagine, where I'd be at right now if it wasn't for ARCA.
Now, when you were growing up in Indiana, running midget week and sprint week and things like that, did you envision going the open wheel route, or did you feel like stock cars was the more profitable avenue?
For me, obviously, growing up in Indiana, the Indianapolis 500 is obviously close to home, but IndyCars, for whatever reason, has never really caught my interest like NASCAR stuff did. For me, the guys I looked up to were always sprint car drivers. It seemed like the sprint car guys always went NASCAR racing. Tony Stewart, obviously, he did both, but Tony and Jeff Gordon and Kasey Kahne and J.J. Haley, Stenhouse, all those guys, you'd watch them race, at Bloomington and Putnamville and all those places, and then they'd go run NASCAR and start off in ARCA. So for me, the NASCAR deal was just what I wanted to do, and I remember growing up, we'd go sprint car racing Friday, Saturday, watch the cup race on Sunday, and that's just what we did. So NASCAR was always what I'd hoped to do. I never really near thought I would get to do it, just because everybody knows how the sport works now, and my family didn't have money to go sprint car racing, let alone do anything like that. And, we didn't have any sponsors or anything, and looking back now, and pretty crazy to think, just 2.5-3 years ago, I was still sleeping on couches, volunteering at race shops, trying to get opportunities, and now I've got 2 truck wins and an Xfinity win, so it's pretty crazy to think about for sure.
And one other aspect of this that I'm a little curious about, Toyota's driver development program is pretty intense. I mean, they put a lot of money and effort into it, and it seems like Chevrolet hardly does anything at all. On the Ford side, there's been some, but it's been kind of hit or miss. How big was it for you to have the people at Ford step up and kind of throw a lot into your career to not only get you this ride at the Roval, but, I mean, they've had you running all over the world in all sorts of different kinds of Ford performance cars.
Yeah, Ford's been, such a blessing in my career just because, the ARCA deal, obviously, running for the Cunninghams, it was because the Cunningham guy believed in me and wanted to give me a chance, but after that, you know, there really wasn't anywhere for me to go. There was nothing for me to race. And, you know, Ford stepped up and offered me a contract to go run, you know, for Brad Keselowski. And then we had success there. And then it's translated over now where this year they've got me running Xfinity cars. You know, I got to run the truck race at Eldora. And then, like you said, I'm running sports cars all over the place. So they do everything they can to develop me and get me better as just a better race car driver. And I think certainly running the sports car stuff this year has translated really well to running good at the Roval. And it was pretty cool because all, you know, the high up guys at Ford and the Ford development people were at the Roval. So it was neat to be able to have them there, kind of reward them and see the progression from the start of the year when we went to Daytona for the road course race, then winning the Roval.
And I want to hit a little bit on Ford a little bit more because according to some people, we heard it a lot after you won this past weekend, and me included, I think you're one of the best young prospects in NASCAR. So when Ford took a chance on you, what do you think they saw in you that, you know, that they took a risk on?
Honestly, I don't know, just to be completely honest with you. I know, honestly, Brad Keselowski had a lot of say in initially getting my deal started. He kind of came to me and was trying to figure out how to get me in the trucks because he was a firm believer in the ARCA program, and he watched a lot of the races and I guess saw something in me. And they had an existing sponsor already at BKR with Cooper Standard, but there was still kind of a gap there to be able to get me to run there. So he had went to Ford and told him what his plan was and how he wanted me to run there, and Ford decided to sign me to, you know, a multi-year deal. And it's just progressed to now where I'm the one and only guy. So it's really nice. You know, obviously Toyota does a lot with everything they do, but they got a lot of drivers in the pipeline and not a ton of seats where at Ford, you know, I'm the only guy over there for development stuff. So it makes it really nice just because I get so many opportunities and there's so many avenues for me to go, whether it's, you know, a Roush Fenway or a Penske or a Stuart Haas. You know, I'm not committed to any one team. I can be any of the four teams. So as a driver, you know, that's everything he asked for, is to be a manufacturer guy, and Ford's done so much to, you know, develop me as the best race car driver I can be.
Yeah, and you mentioned to me earlier in the year how it's been kind of challenging to be in the car only then once a month or so. I mean, you've been in it more frequently now between the 60 and the 98, but how is it hard to get in that constant rhythm when you're not in the car on a weekly basis?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's tough to race against guys that are doing it each and every week, and, you know, this is only, I think this year, I've only still ran 50-something pavement races my entire life. So I feel like every race I go run, I still learn so much. And I still don't necessarily know where my fenders are just because I haven't done it enough. And when you're only in them once a month, it does make it hard to go competing against guys that do it each and every week. And, you know, I don't still necessarily know what I need, you know, in the race car to race good. You know, the truck, I figured it out, and the ARC car, I figured it out, but the Xfinity car, I haven't had that consistent basis of being in the car each and every week to know what I need to race good. And here lately, I've been starting to kind of figure out what I need, and we've been running a lot better. So, but it is tough for sure to run once a month, and, you know, it makes it really nice. It makes you more versatile when you're running a sprint car 1 week, a midget 1 week, or even, there's been a couple weeks I've ran a sports car and the sprint car on the same day, and you're jumping in and out of race cars, but it does make it tough when you go back, and it only takes you a couple laps to kind of figure it back out and get back in the rhythm of things.
Zach Neff, any final questions for Chase before we let him go?
Yeah, I asked you about what it meant, you know, to win for that team this past weekend, but I wanted to know who congratulated you. Was there anybody who kind of reached out who kind of surprised you?
Yeah, I had a lot of really cool people. Obviously, Tony called me there in Victory Lane, and Bad Nelson called me. I had a text message from Brad, obviously. Jeff Gordon texted me. That was really cool. Harvick texted me. So a lot of guys that I looked up to, you know, texted me. Dale Jr. tweeted at me. So a lot of – it was really cool. The amount of people and peers, that's all you can ask for, is that your peers like you and respect you. And it was really neat to have, you know, all the fellow drivers come and congratulate me, and were just generally happy for me. So it was really nice to see.
Very cool.
I'm a little curious. Gosh, it's probably been 4, maybe 5 years ago now. You were standing in the infield at Millbridge Speedway, good old Millbridge alumni, and some guy was just randomly talking to you and didn't realize you were a race car driver. Are you at least now getting recognized a little bit more for being a professional race car driver than you were back then?
Yeah, Yeah, it's crazy still to have people recognize me. So I'm still definitely no Dale Jr., but it's crazy to me when I'm in street clothes that people even recognize me. But yeah, I miss going to Millbridge each and every week. And I remember, you know, when I was sleeping on couches there for a while and volunteering, I kind of told myself in my head, hey, you know, if you could just run for the Millbridge points, that'd be cool. You could still race every week. And I just never thought I would be to where I'm at now. So to be able to be here, I'm just certainly blessed, to say the least. And definitely looking forward to the Millbridge race coming up for Keith Kinnon. That's going to be exciting to go to and watch and see the next guy that kind of gets a shot.
I say, now, they're not giving you a shot in that, are they?
Nah, I can't do that one.
Because you're a little too well known.
I don't know about that. I think the last time I raced at Millbridge, I took down a couple billboards. And I haven't raced Minneapolis Heart since then.
I believe I remember that as well. Now, are you going to the Chili Bowl?
Yeah, I'll be at the Chili Bowl this year. This is going to be the first year at a couple that I haven't driven my own car. So I'm excited to see how that goes. I'm going to drive for a different team, and I'm going to try to find somebody to run my car. So it will definitely be a different experience, to say the least.
No, throw Ross Weiss in your car. He'll do all right.
I'm okay on that one.
Now, Chase, we'll get you out of here on this one. There's been a lot of rumors, and obviously you won this past weekend, so your stock has gone up. Ford believes in you. But do you know what 2019 holds yet or no?
Nah, not yet. Still working on it. You know, Ford's assured me that I'm going to be in something, and I'll be racing something. I just don't know what it is yet. They're still trying to figure out the best thing that makes sense, not only for me, but also for them and long term. You know, the whole goal when I first signed with Ford was is they wanted to develop a cup driver, and that's their whole goal, is to turn me into a cup driver. So that's the biggest thing, is just trying to figure out long term what makes the most sense and seeing what team makes the most sense to go do that with. So I'm sure I'll be in something, just not quite sure what it is yet.
Well, cool, man. We look forward to your progression, and thanks for joining us on the Front Stretch Podcast this week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah,
thanks, guy.
Zach Neff, obviously Chase, big talent in NASCAR, super popular win this week.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty shocked, to be honest. I mean, when I saw him get up front, you know, through strategy, I really didn't expect him to hang on to the lead for so long. I didn't have him even near my mind when it came to picking winners, and I saw him take the lead. I'm like, oh, it's good for him. Him some laps out front. It's been a tough year. He's turning it around a little bit, but he never let it go. I mean, he led over half the race and survived some pressure situations from Hemric and Justin Marks at the end, lap traffic, restarts. I mean, he really came through with some pretty solid speed and just a tremendous drive overall. I was impressed, and he's proving he's a jack of all trades from what I just asked him earlier, from his Homestead win last year, Adora, now Volvo, his sports car stuff. I mean, you try finding consistencies in what he's good at, and it's really tough to find, and that's always good news for a race car driver.
It's pretty crazy to me to think that somehow Midwest dirt has become a training ground for road racers. I mean, how is it that we've got Clint Bowyer and Chase Briscoe and Casey Kane and Jeff Gordon are growing up on Midwest dirt, going out here becoming these great road racers? I don't know how this has happened the way it has happened, but it's amazing to me that, because Chase is amazing on dirt. I mean, he's kind of new to the NASCAR scene and haven't had a lot of exposure of his dirt success to the NASCAR family yet, but he can get it done in any kind of an open wheel dirt car. And it's just, I was surprised as you were. I'm like, it's cool to see him up there, but I just didn't think that would be a prowess he would have. But then, if you look at the fact that he's been running GT40s and some other road racing type stuff, once it translates from cars specifically built to road race versus stock cars road racing, it's a lot easier, I think, to road race a stock car once you've had the experience in purpose-built road racing car.
Yeah, and it's crazy, and he mentioned this too, how quickly he adapted to pavement racing. He said he's only probably driven 50 pavement races or so in his career. I mean, Zach, if you look at the ARCA series in 2016, he tore it up en route to the championship. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens with him going forward. I expect big things out of him. And I really hope he gets a full-time ride next year. But guys, let's talk some Roval. All right, y'all, we might as well keep this show going because we had the roll for this weekend and it was crazy. Zach, I know you were there. It's one of the best finishes, in my opinion, in recent memory, even better than Chicago, in my personal opinion. But Zach, since you were there, take me through your reactions through the whole weekend and then the cup race.
Yeah, just to start with the track, I mean, it was certainly one of the most fun days. I mean, the most fun weekends I've ever had in my entire career in the sport so far. From the time I walked into the track on Friday and saw the infield catch fencing to the front stretch chicane and the whole heartburn turn that they set up, I mean, I was in complete awe. And it caused some heartburn, if you ask Clint Boyer.
I did, absolutely.
Yeah, I was in complete awe of what we were doing and out of this world. It seemed like something out of a fantasy, something that a crazy NASCAR fan would conjure up in his head. Oh, why don't we run a race through the infield road course at Charlotte? And it happened. We did it. And I know as a photographer, it was beyond a blast. As someone who takes photos, you always search for those creative opportunities. And this track had a number of great vantage points and spots where you can see the cars coming in really quick and you can work with angles. And I'm so fortunate I got to see the course up close and I felt like I learned a lot about what the drivers were really handling out there. And I know other photographers would stop me while I was shooting and say, you know what, on paper, I was pretty skeptical about this track and this race, but seeing it in the flesh, wow. And that was the mood throughout the whole weekend. Wow. I mean, it was pretty shocking. And I really have to give credit to Charlotte and the Smith family for all that they did. I mean, they did it, and they were proactive about the restart zone, for one, not using the chicane. I think we avoided some issues that possibly could have happened there, and they were reactive about the tire barriers on the backstretch after those couple accidents. That corner had to be the most treacherous, eye-popping corner I've ever seen. I would just sit there on the backstretch during practice with my camera, and the other photographers were just kind of waiting because they would come through and just nip that thing every time, flying, and you just couldn't look away every time they came through. But thankfully they fixed that, and overall I was very happy with the track. I was happy with the weekend. It was aesthetically delicious, the whole track. I mean, it was just so much fun to watch the cars go around it, and it was competitive. It opened the door for all sorts of possibilities, and I think at the end of the weekend it produced two races that we won't forget for a long time.
Delicious, a word I didn't think would ever be used on this podcast.
That needs to be the title of the podcast for this week. Aesthetically delicious. That is one of the greatest descriptions I have heard of a racetrack. That is awesome.
But Neff, I mean, when I saw the track for the first time, I guess when they practiced it, because you saw pictures on social media and whatnot, but it did look beautiful. I mean, when you watch a road course, and you could call it a street course, I guess, if you wanted to, because you could see the whole thing, and then you don't see that at Sonoma. You can see a lot of the track. A Watkins Glen, you can see just when they go by. But this, as a fan, if I were to go to any race, because you know you don't know what you're going to expect at this race for the first time anyway, I would want to go to the Roval now.
First off, I would like to apologize because I had fervently believed that it was going to be an abject disaster.
We all
and
did.
I was 1,000% wrong. There were passing opportunities everywhere. There were guys running side by side all over the place. It was fantastic. So I was wrong. I'm the first one to admit I was wrong. And now I'm honestly disappointed that they let the drivers talk him into making it easier. Because the original layout of the Roval had more curves in the infield, and now I'm wishing that was in there because I think it would have been even more exciting if we'd have had the additional pieces to it. But that said, unlike Zach, I was disappointed they moved that wall on the backstretch because I loved the fact that idiots were flying through the air running into a wall airborne.
Turtles.
Because they aren't smart. Oh, turtles. I hated that word. I was so tired of hearing about turtles. I'm like, it's a curb. And it's bright blue. And if they can't see it, then they deserve to hit it and have to go to a backup car. Just like the heartburn turn. Oh, my God. I loved the turn. I loved the challenge of turn one. But the fact that we just artificially named it Heartburn Turn before we ever ran a lap drove me bananas. And they were running it all weekend. But that said, the racing was fantastic. The multiple strategies that came involved. There were cautions that flew that changed some people's attitudes and how they attacked some things. I did take offense, or I shouldn't say offense, I felt that there was more played into Keselowski's error than should have been, because they made it up and played it up like that was such a rarity that they had 20 laps on the tires and they had never done that before. There was a restart early in the race that had 17 lap old tires on like the first five cars. So that was more of Brad Keselowski really screwing up and everybody else just kind of following him than it was the old tires. And I was glad to see, I watched Race Hub today, and Brad even mentioned that in looking at the video, he figured out there's braking zones or braking signs on the wall to let you know how far you are from the corner, and he missed one of them. So he thought he was 100 yards or so further from the corner than he was when he got on the brakes, and that was probably why he screwed up so bad. So I had a little bit of a dispute with them blowing it up about how they didn't have any idea how it was going to turn on those tires when it was in actuality they just screwed up where they were turning. But yeah, I thought the racing was fantastic. I thought the end was ridiculous. And I can't think there's anything that shines a greater spotlight on the disarray of the number 48 team than that last lap. I mean, I give Jimmy credit for going for it and trying to win a race, and all we hear about is how wins are everything, and had he pulled it off, it would have been amazing. But at the same time, you're two turns from going to the next round of the playoffs and having a chance to advance and run for a title that you have no right to really be running for based on the way you've run all season. And instead, you drive like a moron and wreck and end up losing that. And I still was confused about that point, too, because when he came across the finish line, they said he was a point to the good. And then somehow in there, he became tied. So I'm not totally sure how that happened.
Well, that was because Kyle Larson passed Jeffrey Earnhardt.
But Johnson finished ahead of him.
Right, so that means they hadn't raced back to the finish line yet. So that means Larson gained a point.
But he was tied with Almirola, and I don't know. Anyway, the Larson thing was amazing, too.
Yes.
That, if you were to put that whole thing in a nutshell, that was the greatest part of that whole deal. Is you're sitting here, Kyle Larson has got a car where the front tires are, I mean, I know it was 45, but it looked like 90 degrees sticking out straight sideways. And he comes into the middle of the backstretch, and his spotter gets on the radio and is like, you got to get here because the 96 just wrecked. And so Larson is literally a minute after the checkered flag started waving, coming to the checkered flag, blows the tire going into four on the oval, and bounces off the wall, heads through the chicane, bounces off the wall again as Earnhardt's starting to finally roll and beats him to the line to create the tie that ultimately puts him in contention to go to the next round. I mean, that just, even for a purist like me that hates the playoffs and knows that the latest version of the playoffs is the best version of them we've got, that was fantastic. And the fact that if Kyle Larson goes on now to win the championship, that would be just the ultimate story, to have him be on the backstretch out of the playoffs at Charlotte to win the championship. That story would be the greatest thing to write, I think.
Well, Zach Neff hit on about every topic that we wanted to hit on, so I guess we could just let him take over. But Neff, we were all skeptical. I mean, you're right, we were. You mentioned last week how you thought more than half the race was going to be running our caution. I said 34 laps. And Michael McDowell called it on Friday, I think on NASCAR Fan America, whatever they call it, Fan Day, saying that if Saturday's show was kind of tame, which it was calm, that Sunday's would kind of be a shit show. And in the end of it was. I mean, it was a good race. We had everything from fuel mileage, late race restarts, obviously the Brad Keselowski and Kyle Larson deal, you know, going down into turn one and not turning. But they raced hard too, and I know it was a fuel mileage race for the time being, but that was just good, clean, hard racing. And I think it was the epitome of racing, especially late in the race. But then Zach, then we had the finish with Truex and Johnson for the win. And I don't know, I feel really happy for Charlotte Motor Speedway, as you mentioned earlier, Zach, because they needed something like this. They needed a change because that second, I mean, to have three races on an oval, you know, one of them being the All-Star race, before this year, they were all the same race, essentially. It was just a mile and a half. And now this year, they've got the All-Star race, which was, you know, the new rules package, which we'll talk about later, the 600, which sucked, and then this race, which was great. So I think it's a big win for the Smith family.
Yeah, and I knew that the true test of the track's success would come in the infield section for the most part. I think once they get onto the oval, we kind of saw them spread out a little bit, which was expected. But when it came to the infield section, I mean, I saw a lot of battles throughout the race. I mean, even when you're shooting in your one corner, you kind of see what you see there. But even through, you got the hard burn turn one, two, three, and four. And there was so much, a lot of close competition, a lot of passing. And obviously that section was highlighted by the Keselowski-Larson battle. That was truly remarkable. I did not think, I mean, as I said last week, I didn't think this was going to be a crapshoot. I was fairly open-minded, but I did not think that you can go side-by-side the entire infield like they did. I mean, that was tremendous.
Crazy.
And I think that proved a lot from Keselowski, mostly because Larson surely had the best car throughout the whole day, and Keselowski just outraced him, and he ended up not only holding him off, but actually driving away again. And you mentioned the strategy part. I definitely really enjoyed that. I mean, that was just an extra factor that usually comes in road course racing, but we saw it to a tenth degree on Sunday, and it set up for some wild moments at the end. And I mean, when it came down to the chaos that I was expected, I know Brendan Gaughan, I spoke to him in the garage after the Xfinity race. He finished 17th. He was bluntly honest. He said that everyone was Chicken Little, saying that the sky was falling, and quote-unquote, he said everyone was getting scared and panicking because it's something we haven't done before. It turns out we're race car drivers, unquote. And to me, that really spoke a lot. I mean, we had four green flag runs of 10 or more laps, including a caution-free stage two and the 31-lap green flag run in the final stage. It really proved what Gaughan told me, that certain people really underestimated the driver's abilities, and when it came to the past test sessions or whatever, it certainly changed on the race weekend. And visually, I think a lot of people in their heads had insanity and chaos, but when it actually happened, it worked out well, at least up until the end with that finish that everyone's talking about. And when you have craziness and late race restarts with a turn one that really had a lot of difficulty to it, something like that, it's a possibility. And Jimmy was being a race car driver. I mean, he tried to win, and I'm thrilled he wasn't thinking about the points. I'm thrilled that he went for the win. I'm thrilled that Martin Truex was pissed, even though he is already locked into the next round. And I have no problem with the move that he made. I mean, it was obviously a mistake. If he spun on his own, perhaps it would have been a little bit different when it comes to the reaction. But I know being in person, when it came to the thrill of it all, I mean, the reaction was absolutely insane from the crowd. You can barely hear the crowd over the sounds of everybody's jaws dropping. It was just indescribable what we were going through. And I personally couldn't see the start-finish line. I was kind of behind the pit wall watching the TV. I saw Jimmy's 48 spin, and I go to get a picture, and then I hear the crowd yell a second time. And then I see Blaney come through, and I'm like, what just happened? And it was wild, and it was all for that first Volvo win, and obviously that meant a lot to anybody who was in that race on Sunday.
And Neff, I mean, you kind of hit on this earlier in your little rant, but, you know, Jimmy hasn't won in 50-something races, so I guess I can't really blame him for going after the win. I mean, we're seven races away for this being the first season, first full year, that he hasn't won in his career, at least one race, so... And I, you know, he just wants to win. He's a seven-time champion. But on the flip side, yeah,
he came into the race 6 points out of advancing.
And going into
going into that corner, he is 7 points to the good.
Exactly.
And you heard him.
Didn't he go for the win though? If he just sat in second.
See, I don't fight.
I would not have been, because of the fact that's the prudent, intelligent thing to do. I mean, I would have liked to have seen him make it tough and maybe get to the back bumper a little bit, But to just bonsai it so bad that you're completely out of control and you take two cars out was not what I wanted to see out of him. So I guess if I had seen him, like, kind of Jack Martin up a little bit and maybe try to do a bump and run, then, yeah, I would have been fine with it. But the fact that he just – I mean, it was worse than Carl Edwards pulling that bonsai move at Kansas years ago when he just sailed it into three and pounded it off the wall to try and pass Jimmy. I mean, it was so out of control. And the fact that he's trying to say that it was his best corner, and it may have been that he was fast through there, but he was – there was no chance he was turning that car if he didn't run into Martin at some point there. And – Or wreck himself, which is what he did. So that was, like I said, if he had tried to push him out of the way or bump and run him or something like that, then yeah, I'd be cool with it. But the way he went about it, it was just dumb. And I'm just like, again, when you're at that point, knowing, and where I'm looking at it is he's got Dover next week.
Yeah,
it's Jimmy Johnson at Dover
Playground.
I mean, there's few things that are as sure in racing as that, even though he hasn't won it in a couple. But it's less than 2 years since he's won there. So I feel like it was the Cinderella story getting ready to happen, that he was going to manage to advance into the next round, that he was going to win at Dover, that he's going to win at Martinsville, and then something magical would happen at Homestead and he would win number eight. And fans would lose their minds. And now instead, we see him standing on pit road and Dave Burns comes up to tell him that you missed the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't fault him, though, because when's the last time he was this close to a win? It might have been Dover last June.
It's because his best finish of the year is eighth.
He's had a couple top fives.
But no, that was why he didn't advance, because eighth was his best finish.
Oh, no, in the playoffs, yes.
Playoffs, sorry.
Yes, in the playoffs. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I agree with you on it was a, I guess, dumb move because he would have been in. He would have had a shot at the championship. He was going to Dover next week, Jimmy Johnson's playground, as you mentioned. But I don't know. A win's a win, and he did say after the race, obviously, you know, a championship's bigger than a race win. But I think him going winless for 50-something races now, you know, it's weighing on him.
Oh, absolutely. Trust me, and he is intimately aware of the fact that he is way closer to the end of his career than the beginning of his career. And talk about eight all you want, and he would love to win number eight. He knows that the odds of him winning number eight are shrinking at a rapid rate. And as bad as they've been running for the last 2 years, those odds aren't going to be getting any better unless something drastic happens in the offseason and they really turn some things around. And at this point, I don't know that there's any reason to think that's going to happen other than the new rules, which we'll talk about later. But I feel like he knows that this was probably the best shot he's got at winning number eight, and he just pissed it away because he was a race car driver. That's all we can say. They put their helmet on when they're a race car driver, and they lose all sense.
See,
nothing amplified that more than him wrecking coming through that last corner.
Zach, I don't know about you, but I don't really agree with that. This being his last, you know, good shot, because we've seen Chevrolet all year struggle with the Camaro. And really, in the playoffs alone, they started to pick up some speed. We've seen Alex Bowman run well. It doesn't matter if it's an oval, short track, road course, mile and a half, didn't matter. I mean, they've all had speed. And this was, Zach, this was his best shot at winning all year.
Oh, yeah, not even close. I mean, I would have been more concerned with him if he didn't try to go for a win.
Exactly.
If he didn't even have desperation on his mind. I mean, we talked about his winless streak. It would have been his first win of the year, would have got him into the next round. I don't think I had him going on to the next round. I mean, this would have been a first win ever on the Roval. You would have been the inaugural winner. I mean, when you're in the heat of the car like that, I mean, you just try something. And
Oh, yeah, and I think that probably played into his mind, too. Don't underestimate the fact that Lowe's Motor Speedway was Jimmy's playground, and since it came back to the Charlotte Motor Speedway, it has not really been his playground.
Yeah.
And you know that he wanted to have his name on that trophy first. You can bet on that.
Yeah, and plus, where's Lowe's going next year?
Yeah.
I mean, he's got so much on his mind, not alone this podcast and every other media outlet who's been just hammering down his throat, I mean, just saying just how his performance is, and it's rightfully so, because he's been he's been in a spot that he's never been in his career. I mean, for so long, he was nowhere near this, you know, and I wasn't surprised at all with what he did. I mean, it's just, you look at the result and, you know, it's easy to play Monday morning quarterback, but it's just something that happened, and I really wasn't surprised.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, going into the final lap, I didn't think he had a real shot. Because Truex, yeah. I mean, he caught Truex with two to go. And then on the last lap, coming out of the chicane, man, he was there. And I'm thinking, he's going to get it. And then, yes, he wheel hopped going into the inner loop there. And what happened, happened. But I don't know, man. We'll have to see what happens going forward. But I want to move on here a little bit because we got a lot to talk about. Neff, you kind of brought it up earlier, but Kyle Larson, he had the dominant car on Sunday, winning stage one, and he led the most laps. I think it was 53 or something. I'm not looking at the stats in front of me, but
47.
Okay. But, man, he had an adventure last, you know, 10 laps or so when him and Keselowski drove it up off into the tire barrier, I guess you could call it. His car was destroyed. As you mentioned, probably 45 degrees, the right front tires, the whole suspension was broken. But then that last lap, you couldn't script that enough.
No, and the worst thing of all of it was, if Keselowski doesn't bounce back from the tires, I think Larson would have cleared him and not wrecked in that first corner. I really do. It's just the way that the Keselowski hit into it and the car rolled back just enough to catch him, and that turned his right front into the tires, which killed it. But yeah, he had the car to beat. There was no question about it, even though he didn't lead much over the last half of the race. He was by far, I thought, the best car of the day. I mean, I know Brad was in there, and Brad drove it like a champion to try to run that fuel strategy, but still put himself in front and make Larson beat him. But when it was all said and done, man, and again, kudos to them. If that race is one lap longer, then yeah, they're probably out.
They would be out because they wouldn't have made minimum speed. You get three laps. And there was no way he was making minimum speed, you know?
Right. Because you get three laps from the time you get black flagged. And I don't think they black flagged him on those first two laps after the restart.
No.
So technically, he could have had two or three more laps. But if it went, you know, if we had two or three green-white checkers, then, yeah, there's no chance that he's in the running. But it just, they got that thing functional, as loosely interpreted as that can be for functional. And, you know, he's out there just limping it around. And like he said, he's watching the pylon and he sees it. Yeah, passed. And it's like, I'm out. And if you heard Radioactive tonight on TV, they're talking to him and he's like in the middle of the backstretch. And he's like, we're done, right? And they're like, yeah. And then all of a sudden they're like, get here, earn our wreck, get here. And it's like, so he just hammers it down, knowing he's going to blow the tire, blows the tire, hits the wall, then knocks the wall down again coming out of the chicane, and still manages to get to the start-finish line before Earnhardt did. And he had all these people blaming Earnhardt like he wasn't trying. And, I mean, I saw Jeffrey's tweet about it. When you spin backwards, crazy stuff happens to your engine, and it sucked all the oil up into the engine, out of the system, so it takes it a while to get all that cleared and reset. And, you know, that's one of the disadvantages of having EFI, is that there's computer codes that prevent the thing from restarting until they get properly set. Which also, give Jimmy credit on that, too. I mean, the fact that he spun backwards, his car was stopped, and he got it refired, took off, then had the presence of mind to come to a complete stop again so that he didn't get penalized, which I would have loved to have seen if he had just gone for it, if they would have penalized him. That would have been a whole lot of fun. you'd have some people screaming bloody murder if he wrecked Truex and then turned around and just hammered it down and ended up winning the race without coming to a stop from blowing off the chicane. That would have put NASCAR in a very unenviable position, which, lucky for them, Jimmy did not do.
Yeah.
That could have been fun.
Yeah, I don't think he would have won. I think he would have got probably third or fourth, but that would have put him in the playoffs. And NASCAR, going into the weekend, said that, you know, if you don't come to a complete stop in the bus stop or inner loop, whatever you want to call it, it's a 30-second penalty. Same with the chicane. So it would have been really interesting, Zach. But Zach, you, like we said, you were there, so I don't know if you talked to Kyle Larson, but it just blows my mind what happened on that last lap.
Yeah, it was arguably, I mean, in my opinion, it was the wildest moment in playoffs history when it came to everything that was going on those last 45 seconds. And he was, yeah, I didn't speak to him personally, but I mean, we were on pit road and we're all kind of in the scrum there. And he said it was damn good luck and luck that they really needed. And you usually don't hear that from a driver whose car had to be towed off pit road on a rollback because the thing was destroyed. I mean, I could not believe when I saw the camber on that tire. When he got back on that track, I'm like, oh, God, that thing's going to fall. He's not going to finish his race. It was, what, two laps, three laps? But, I mean, yeah, he was all the way in the back, and he was so funny how he was kind of recapping what the team was telling him and what was going through his head, and he knew that tire was going to explode. When they said go, he's like, all right, guess I'm gonna go.
We're going to blow this
and,
one.
Yeah, it exploded, hit turn four, and I was in the tri-oval, and I saw Earnhardt stopped. And I saw him come by and pound the wall. I'm like, what? What's he doing? And now I know why. I found out a few seconds later that was his biggest pass of the day. And definitely just an incredible finish. And I really have to give it up to Larson. I mean, he has had a lot of bad luck this year. I can't believe that wins haven't been coming nearly as much as I really expected. And to see him get eliminated from that would have been a huge tragedy. I mean, I think there's potential with him. And I think he can do a lot at Dover this weekend to kind of help his season. But to go through that with that amount of luck, I don't think he's going to be complaining anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree. And he could do a lot of damage this weekend because he led 241 laps there in spring of 2017. So it is one of his better tracks. I mean, in 2016, that classic battle with Matt Kenseth and Chase Elliott for the win. But guys, we're deep into this podcast, and we briefly hit on Ryan Blaney, who picked up the victory. His first for Team Penske, and in the number 12, it's its first win since 2008, the Daytona 500. He's moving on to the next round. Zach, I'll throw it back to you. I expected him to score enough points to move on. It was closer than I thought if had it played out, and you know, we had the fuel mileage race with him, Bowman, and Boyer all pitting within a lap of each other because they didn't want to let the next one get out of each other's sights once Bowman pitted. And he won stage two, but I'll be honest, I didn't consider him a favorite. I know he's a decent road racer, but he also, you know, on Saturday, or was it Friday? Friday, he hit the tire barrier in the chicane.
Yeah, and during the race, during that Keselowski-Larson wreck, he got a little bit piece of that. And yeah, I agree. I mean, I had him going pretty far into the playoffs, and he came in pretty close, and I knew that he was going to be in a tough spot. I didn't see him as a road course talent, you know, by any means, but I knew that he certainly had a chance. And yeah, he won stage two. I mean, he had a solid car, but I mean, man, what a win. I mean, those type of wins when it just gets thrown onto your lap. I mean, he was honest after the race. He told us how this win, he didn't want to use the word undeserving, but he felt like it was kind of awarded to him, and it was. I mean, it wasn't a Pocono 2017 type of deal where he just battled Harvick to the bitter end and just beat out a champion, you know, straight up. But I mean, it's a big win nonetheless. I mean, anytime you're a first winner at a new track, I mean, that's huge. After his early season speed, I mean, dominating a number of races, I'm surprised it took this long. And for him personally, anytime you win a race for Penske, it's a huge deal. And as I said, I'm surprised it took to the playoffs for him to get that first win this year. But it's a big one, and I think that this is another win for Penske. I think four of the last five races now, and we just need those guys to actually show winning speed instead of just having these wins either get thrown onto the lap or kind of through strategy of, I mean, they've been winning them anyway, except having a winning car, it seems like.
Yeah, and I talked to Ryan Indy, and he mentioned two of the things that you just mentioned, Zach. Winning for Roger Penske, it's huge for him. And putting the 12 car back in victory lane, also very big. But Neff, Zach hit on it there. They've won four out of five. Keselowski won three in a row. He probably, you could argue that he deserved to win Vegas. Truex had probably the best car. But Keselowski won there. He won Indy. He won Darlington. And now Blaney won, you know, the Roval. So Team Penske's kind of getting hot at the right time here.
Scoreboard. Yeah. That's all you got to say about that. You can say that they don't have fast cars. You can say a strategy. Yep. Say whatever it is. They're winning. And until you're going to start beating them, they can keep talking about that. Now, I feel like that'll change this weekend. I think you're going to go back to one of these other guys winning. But they're definitely peaking. I mean, it may not be the peak that they need to go all the way to the championship, but they're definitely at the high point of their performance for the season. And I feel like all their teams, Logano the least of the three, but all their teams seem to be doing pretty well across the board, from strategy to performance to pit stops. Everything seems to be running pretty well. So they may not be the organization to beat. I still think Stuart Haas as an organization is the best. I mean, they've got four of the eight. So you got to, or four of the 12, excuse me. So you got to look at them as formidable. But Penske's got three teams, all of whom I think could win a race at any time. And I don't think that your four that you've got out of Stuart Haas, I don't feel like any of them could win a race at any time. I think a couple of them would really have to have some things line up properly to get there. So I feel like Penske, if anybody has bragging rights right now, it's them. And we'll see how this next round plays out. When we get down to eight, I think we're going to have a far better image of who's going to be the ones to beat. I still feel like Kyle Busch is the best of all of them. And again, got caught up in Brad's thing that pretty much ended their day there. And I think he was in a position as well where I thought he was going to give them a real run there coming down to the end. And Harvick was just, I felt like Harvick was just kind of there this weekend. I didn't really hear a lot out of him, and you didn't see him near the top of the charts at all very much. He was just kind of an also-ran this weekend, but I feel like that'll change dramatically on Sunday.
Yeah, because he won at Dover in the spring. And it's worth noting, you know, that the Blaney picked up six playoff points, and coming into the Roval, he only had seven. So that's 13 now, and those could be crucial, as we saw every point counts. But as he moves on, who won't be moving on in terms of the championship, guys, Eric Jones, Denny Hamlin.
Eric Jones, thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm a dumbass for picking him going the Final Four. Austin Dillon, who had an adventurous weekend, and then Jimmy Johnson, as we alluded to earlier. But, guys, it just feels so weird to me that neither Jimmy nor Denny have a shot at the championship after the first round.
Yeah, especially Denny. Jimmy, we've all documented for a while that the 48 team's been struggling, but Denny has had numerous opportunities this year to win races and has been beaten on the door of top fives all season long. And to have him, and again, we talked about it after Indy, that with that disappointment at Indy, things could go one of two directions. And in hindsight, as we look at it now, it went the other direction. I truly feel like it got in his head at Indy, and it never got out. And it just seems to me that, like, through this whole first round of the playoffs, that it was back to the storm cloud over Eeyore's head, and it just wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, Zach, but he had a disastrous first round. I mean, anything that went wrong kind of did go wrong. The Roval alone. He had, what, two or three crashes on Friday between practice and qualifying. You just don't see that out of a caliber of a driver that Denny Hamlin is.
You don't. I mean, it was kind of both. I mean, it was Eric Jones pretty much had the exact same type of round. I mean, when he started off with the pole at Vegas, I'm like, all right, here we go. He's going to keep this top 10 streak at least. I mean, possibly get, you know, top fives and survive here. And I expected Denny after Indy, I thought perhaps he was getting on to something. And God, I mean, yeah, you said it. It was a complete disaster. Just all those races, and it just culminated into just a downright disappointing weekend for both guys. They had multiple practice accidents, and just the whole weekend seems like they just couldn't keep themselves out of trouble from the restarts and everything that went down later. They just did not survive. They didn't do what they had to do, and man, that's half a JGR. I mean, that's one of the best teams with the 18, and, you know, Suarez didn't even make it. He wasn't even close, and these two, I mean, this was, to me, those two were really important for Gibbs, because we know the 18's got it. We know the 19 doesn't. It's these middle two guys who I really wanted to see improve throughout these last 10 races to kind of show that they're more of a one-trick pony when it comes to guys contending for wins and titles. And have them both not finish better than 12th in the championship confirmed. That's a huge negative. And unfortunately, with these last three races and perhaps most of the regular season, it's not a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at his stats right now, and he got off to a really good start this year. He led a bunch of laps at the beginning. He led a lot of 111 in Martinsville. Never got that win, though, which, you know, is obviously disappointing. He also has never gone a full year without winning. But, man, it looks like once the 600 came around, he finished third there. But once Pocono came around the week after, it just kind of, he was average. I mean, 6th to 15th or so. He won a whole bunch of poles, but that never translated to the race. As soon as the race started, he just fell back, Neff. And that's also something we're not accustomed to seeing out of him.
Absolutely. It's kind of hard to understand that you're dealing with a Toyota and an organization in Gibbs and in Toyota that is putting a tremendous amount of resources behind having success at this level. And let's face it, their success at this level is tied to Joe Gibbs Racing. Whether it's through the satellite of Furniture Row or not, it still all is flowing through the Joe Gibbs organization. And when you turn around and have one of the two flagship drivers of your organization just be a disappointment, you got to wonder. I mean, there's all sorts of discussion going around with silly season and new rides being announced and everything as to where Christopher Bell's going to go. And you got to think he's going to end up at Gibbs, but whose seat's he going to take? And it's going to be weird because Denny is tight with FedEx, and that's a big check to lose. But I can't imagine them pushing Kyle out because Kyle's tight with M&M's and Interstate. That if they're going to lose somebody, I feel like Denny's the one they're going to lose, and that's hard to imagine going forward.
Yeah, but like you said, he has FedEx. That's a huge check. I mean, I think they're the only sponsor that's really sponsoring every race, because I don't even think he had Sports Clips on the car this year. They used to sponsor the throwback race at Darlington, and this year he had the throwback FedEx from his childhood paint scheme. Yep. So, yeah, that's a huge check, and I don't know. I don't know about that one, but I do know that we're going to Dover this weekend, Zach, and we got Talladega and Kansas in the round of 12. So now the next question is, you know, who are the next four out?
The next four out, I mean, there was a couple surprises to me of guys who made it in. Bowman was a surprise to me, and Eric Almirola.
Yep.
I mean, I know he's got a lot of potential in that 10. We've seen him almost win a couple races this year, but I didn't really think he would be able to put three races together, especially since he was winless and he didn't have much of a cushion. But, yeah, I mean, I kind of played it safe this last time. I didn't have Denny and Eric going out, as I said, but I would say this time it's really, really tough to say. I mean, a lot of the points, if you look from, like, I think it's around fifth, kind of like where Boyer is, all the way down, they're playing with individual points.
15.
I mean, the difference.
Yeah, 15 total points from 12th to 5th.
That's insane. That's crazy. That's almost one stage. I mean, I think we're going to be seeing guys racing for 10th on the one-third mark of races more than ever before. I mean, we've had ties in the past in the playoffs, but to have a three-way tie for the cutoff spot and go into a track like Dover and, as you said, Talladega, I mean, everybody, it's going to be similar to this last round because nobody wants to be in position even when that race is even nearby. To pick out the four, I mean, it's going to be really tough, and I think that's a good sign. But there could be very big surprises. I mean, as you said, there's certain drivers who, when they get on bad streaks of bad luck or their head's not in the right place, I mean, things can go in a downward spiral quickly, and it can happen to anybody. So I'm pretty open-minded, but when I look at the bottom, I mean, I think Bowman is somebody who I have doubts about. I know he's a good plate racer. He did well at Talladega this year. He's going to have the Earnhardt crowd cheering him on in that 88, like in the spring, so there's a lot of possibilities, but those final four, it's gonna be interesting who gets kicks out, because I think there are gonna be at least one big surprise.
So out of that, no predictions.
I was saying, so your prediction is.
Prediction of first four out.
Yeah, get your four out.
Four out. Okay,
Alex. Or next Bowman, four out, I guess it would be.
Alex Bowman, Eric Almirola, Chase Elliott, and pulling Rick Allen here, and Joey Logano. Let's say Logano's going to be out.
See, I agree with three of those. I agree with three of those, and one of them is Logano, and Almirola and Bowman. But Logano, because Neff, I mean, he could get on a hot streak. He could be the next Penske driver that kind of takes off. We've seen him do it in the second round of the playoffs before, sweeping the round a couple years back. But there's just something about that team that they're just average this year. I mean, they won Talladega in the spring, granted, and we're going.
I do not vote against Logano at Talladega. He has been on fire at Talladega the last couple of years.
So is Kozlowski. It'll be interesting. This round's going to be huge, and I don't know if the first round was any, example of what we're going to set for this round. It's going to be insane. Because dwindles down.
I think we're going to be more insane, and I think going forward for years to come, it's going to continue to get more insane because these guys are figuring it out more and more how to race this format. And as Zach just mentioned, stage points are going to be even bigger. Now that you've got these guys sitting in the garage looking at it going, man, one position at at a course where we pitted early to try and position ourselves for a win when we could have finished seventh and gotten 3 points, that could have put us in the next round or got us in the next round when it shouldn't have. I think you're going to see even more and more strategy plays to try to get in position to finish in the top 10 for every stage.
Think about Talladega when the big one looms at any time, and more times than not, lately anyways, it starts at the front. So it'll be interesting whether you want to stay in the back, not risk anything, put yourself in a position for the ending and give up those stage points, but they're so valuable.
Absolutely. I don't see how you can put yourself in a position as crucial as points are these days sorry, I'm distracted. The Cubs just scored. I apologize for that. For those of you that are listening to this 2 days after, and you already know that the Cubs have advanced to the next round of the playoffs, but they just tied it up for right now. So, anyway, but I don't see how you're gonna be able to forego any chance at any kind of points. Kyle Busch, Harvick, maybe Truex because of the cushion of the playoff points that they have, maybe. They can ignore those kind of points. But anybody else, as we said, from Bowyer down to Bowman, you got 15 points separating them to start the round. I don't see how you can ever take a possibility of giving up any kind of points. So that's where I think strategy is going to get crazy. Short pitting, taking two tires sometimes. Staying out when everybody's pitting just to be in a position. You're going to see some crazy calls. And in the end, does it bite people? Do you get somebody that stays out and then blows a tire and then wipes out their whole race or something? And ultimately then their playoffs? Who knows? It could be bananas. But for my four, I'm with you on Bowman. I feel like, God, they dodged so many bullets in this first round. I mean, that car, every race it seemed like that car was on the damage clock at some point in time. And yet they managed to make it to the next round. So I give them credit for that, but I don't picture them making it to the final eight. I'm also going to say Chase Elliott. I feel like at this point of the Chevys, they have regressed. While everybody else seemed to be going forward, I feel like the 9 team has gone backwards. And I feel like that's going to bite them in this round. My third one is Bowyer. Again, kind of like Hamlin, I feel like Bowyer's just got that mentality going on, and they went to Richmond and sucked it up.
Yeah,
and I kind of just feel like that is in the back of the mind right there, that one's gonna be hard to overcome. The other one, man, as much as I don't want to call it out, I think I'm gonna say Ryan Blaney. Coming off this momentum, but I feel like they're the one Penske team that started off the year strong, but of late haven't been doing anything fantastic other than obviously winning the Roval. But over these next three races, I feel like they're the ones that might get bit. And as we've said, I still I want to keep drumming that drum until the head breaks on it, but I think Almirola is going to win at Talladega.
That'd be interesting, and I picked him to win there in the spring. But, yeah, I mean, I said three of my four, Bowman, Almirola at Logano. I'm also going to go Blaney. I was kind of up in the air between Blaney and Chase, but I don't know. I just haven't seen enough out of Blaney. I know he won this past weekend, but he's just also been kind of average, just like Team Penske's kind of been average the whole year, except for the past month. But now we're kind of running long here, and we mentioned we talk about this a little bit, and I'm just going to read off some notes because there's a lot to digest with this new rules package for next year. It'll be similar to it'll be similar to what we saw in the All-Star race. Let's quickly talk about it. So it's going to limit the horsepower with a tapered spacer, not a restrictor plate, except for Daytona 500. And the range in horsepower between 550 to 750, depending on what size of the track. The spoiler's going to be larger. 2-inch overhang on the splitter. And the goal of this, which Steve O'Donnell, NASCAR's chief racing developmental officer, said, is it's going to bring the racing closer together. Now, from what I've read on Twitter, it seems like it was a collaborative unit of the owners, and they pushed for this because they didn't want to spend more money than they had to between different kind of packages. But as we've had drivers on the podcast here before, Corey LaJoy, when he first heard about it this year in April, that they're going to use it in the All-Star race, he said that it's going to take it more out of the driver's hands, but NASCAR thinks otherwise. They think it's going to do the opposite. So, Neff, you know, you're very technical. You do tech talk every week. What are your thoughts on this?
First of all, and I heard it from multiple people while I was sitting at Martinsville's Media Center this weekend, 550 horsepower.
Yeah.
At the peak of stock car racing in the United States for roughly half of your schedule, your cars are going to make 550 horsepower. For those of you that were at the Martinsville late model race this weekend, those cars were cranking out somewhere around 610 to 625. So your cup cars, now mind you, at Martinsville, they'll be cranking out 750.
Right.
But at Charlotte on the oval, they're going to be busting out a robust 550 horsepower. So I'm disappointed in that, but at the same time, understand it. I'm curious as to their belief that this is going to decrease corner entry speed. I think corner speed itself is going to be higher, but they're saying that corner entry speed is going to be lower just because they're going to be slower down the straightaway.
And we saw that in the All-Star race. You know,
I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing. I feel like that's a bad thing. And the one thing that's not happening, and you know is the one thing I was truly praying for out of this deal, was that they would get the stupid side skirts off of these things. But they are not. They're still going to have them sealed off and pinned down to the ground. And I still say that's the biggest hurdle to overcome with these cars. But from a racing perspective, I think you'll get more, hopefully, as they continue to try to get the slingshot maneuvers. Where a guy can get behind somebody and suck up to them and use that momentum to get around them as they're going through a corner. And I think we saw a little bit of that, honestly, this weekend at Charlotte on the oval portion. I think that the guys were kind of using a little bit of a draft. So I think a draft will come into play some, but I applaud them for trying something because we went with a low downforce package and it worked good for about a year. And then over the last year and a half or so, it's kind of gotten back to the same old, same old. So we're now going the complete opposite direction. I would have rather gone even less downforce, take the spoilers all the way off the things. But they're not going to do that, so we're going this way. We're going to have this giant spoiler on the back of it. We'll see. I mean, I know based on recent history, we're going to have a whole year of it. They're not going to change course in the middle of the stream. So whatever we got when we roll into Atlanta is what we're going to have when we roll into Homestead. And I hope that it does what they want. I think you're going to have more pack racing or at least group racing. And that may be a good thing. It may be a bad thing.
Zach, to me, it just literally seems like the cheap way out. I guess you could say it'd be expensive at the beginning, but I don't know. It's just, we need to go back to the racing 10 years ago, and I don't know if we'll ever get there. Like Neff said, take the side skirts off, you know, take the spoiler off, take whatever off. Get these cars where you can get them loose in the corner, which we haven't seen in a while. on a consistent basis, but it just takes more out of the driver's hands, and I'm not a fan of that. And like Neff said, the horsepower, the top series in professional motorsports in the world are going to be turning 550 horsepower at tracks more than 1.3 miles, which is Darlington and up. I mean, Neff, I don't know if you know off the top of your head, but how many miles per hour do you think that's down from current?
I mean, it depends on the track.
Yeah.
But I would be willing to bet at, let's say, Michigan, where they were flying in there at 207 or something at the end of the straightaway, I bet they're going to be doing 180 to 185.
Yeah, so big difference.
It's a big difference, but at the same time, visually, I don't know that it makes a difference.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I've always said that I don't think if you're an average fan and you sit in the stands and you watch cars doing 170 or 210, you're going to see that much of a difference. I just don't think you would visually perceive that much difference in the cars.
Yeah, and that's really what I look at. I really don't think, I mean, I might be wrong, but I don't think fans are really going to care if it's 550 or 650 or 700 horsepower. I think they go off the look of the cars, what the cars look like. That's why Formula One is so popular. They go off the visuals and how the racing is. I mean, that's why I'm fairly optimistic with this. I definitely agree that I think they could have gone further with the low downforce packages from the past. It kind of started in 15 around there, the side skirts and everything that could have been done a little bit more. I think there was more potential there is what I'm trying to say. But I mean, Neff mentioned, you know, the slingshot and the different type of racing is just going to be a different challenge for these guys. And the first thing I did when they announced this was I went back and watched the All-Star race earlier today, and it was a fun race. It was close, and it's going to be close to what we're going to have for next year. We do have different stuff for different tracks. Pocono, Darlington, the 500, as you mentioned, short tracks, road courses won't be affected as much. I look at it in the sense of how the sport is looking at it and what the fans kind of want to see. I was happy with how the All-Star race went. I think that was the best race we've seen in that event in a long time. I think there's a lot of potential there for it helping a lot of smaller teams. I mean, I certainly don't expect this whole hierarchy to be flipped by any means. I think the big teams are always going to be at the top, but I think there's little intricate little adjustments that could bring the field closer together. And I thought the All-Star race was fun. Points races, longer distances, stage racing, a whole bunch of different types of tracks. I mean, it's going to be something that I'm really not sure how it's going to go. I mean, I'm interested to see how, you know, test sessions go and whatnot over the off season, perhaps. But I'm open-minded, but at the same time, I look at it as slightly disappointed that we didn't go further with it in the first section, because I do think it could be exciting and it could work out. But I think what we had before could have worked if we went a little bit further with it.
And one thing I'm really curious to see is I feel like for the first 6 months, they're going to have to take engines back to be dynoed every single week, because these engine builders are going to keep finding horsepower.
Yeah.
And if they have a target of 550, they're going to have to take these things back and they're going to keep tweaking these plates. And at what point do the owners go, okay, let's forget about trying to find more horsepower and go for gains elsewhere? Because they're going to throw a bunch of money at finding more horsepower. They're just going to keep shrinking the plates to take the horsepower on away. So eventually somebody's going to step up and say, maybe we figure out how to get through the air better rather than worrying about the horsepower. So it'll be an interesting dynamic to see how it all plays out as the season goes along. Because like I said, I think for the first 6 months, they're going to be taking three engines back to dyno every single week to make sure that nobody's really blowing them out of the water on horsepower.
Yeah, it'll be something to watch for sure. And, you know, I know this season ain't over yet, but next season's just around the corner. I mean, it's only 4.5 months away, which sounds like a while because we still have 7 weeks left in this year, but it's really not. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the off season, you know, as teams take on this new task of less horsepower, and it'll be interesting. But Neff, We're running long, so I'll give you a couple minutes on, you were at the Martins race, you talked about the late model race. Just mention how you liked it, and I know we were talking off air, some of the stuff you didn't like.
I mean, the Martinsville late model race, you always hear the comparison. It is the Daytona 500 for local late model racers. The NASCAR late model is a perimeter late model that is predominantly run in the Southeast, Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, a little bit in Georgia. But it is the race that we all go to every year, and it's $25,000 to win, and it's the biggest NASCAR late model race that there is. And every year something stupid happens, and it happened again this year. And it's really a frustrating deal just because you're dealing with the biggest race of the year. And, I mean, can you imagine every year go to Daytona and have some kind of goofy officiating call or something weird happen every single year? And that seems to happen at Martinsville. But at the same time, it was a fantastic race. We had some of the top names in late model were running up front and swapping the top spot all day long. And in the end, we had C.E. Falk, who some of you that are at least a little familiar with the Denny Hamlin Short Track Shootout will remember that in the first or second year of that race, C.E. won it at Southside Speedway, which is where that race started, by, I'll be obvious about it, he wrecked Denny Hamlin on the last lap so that he could take that win. He then proceeded to go to the Battle at the Beach several years back, when they had it on the backstretch at Daytona before they tore down the backstretch stands, and was set to win the late model portion of the Battle of the Beach, and Kyle Larson proceeded to wreck the crap out of him, and Kyle Larson took that win. And now this time, the way it worked with scoring loops, they basically had one scoring loop, and it was the start-finish line, and on the final restart, they had three green-white checker attempts, and it was the third one. CE beat Corey Heim to the line by somewhere around a 0.005 of a second, and so that was the last scoring loop, and then there was a wreck in turns 1 and 2. And so even though Corey Heim was ahead of CE for the rest of the lap, they threw the caution out. You went back to the last scored lap, and CE was ahead. So CE got to go home with the clock. And I also don't know how many fans are aware that when you win the clock at Martinsville, they give it to you that night. So you got to find a spot. I know Boyer talked about it when he won in the spring, that they were going to strap it to the top of the SUV. But that's a true thing. At the beginning of the year, sometime in February, they get a delivery at Martinsville of all of the clocks that they're going to give away for the whole year. And every time they have a winner, they wheel that thing out on a two-wheel dolly in a wooden crate, and you put it in your hauler, and you take it home. And CE had a tweet Sunday morning of it in the corner of his house, and he said she's already keeping time. And, I mean, that is one of the coolest things about the late model race. It used to be even cooler because back in the day, they only gave grandfather clocks for people that won on Sundays at Martinsville. So your truck winner, and even when they ran Xfinity did not get a clock because they ran on Saturday. And it used to just be Cup, the modified race, and the late model race were the only people that got clocks. So that was a big deal. But now they give a clock to everybody. But it's still a really big deal. It was a really big event. 72 cars took time. 71 ran into heats. And they dropped the rag on 42 cars. It is an event, to say the least, and they streamed it on Fans Choice. If you didn't get a chance to see it, the replay should be out there really soon. If it's not already, check it out, because it is a spectacle, to say the least.
Yeah, and I saw, I was following Matt Weaver of Auto Week, his Twitter, because he was there as well, and he was blowing it up. And there was a whole bunch of incidents that we won't get into, but some that involved Bubba Pollard, who's an established late model racer in the Northeast.
Yeah, you got Bubba Pollard has never run a late model in his life. Goes out there and was running third on the second green white checker attempt and got wrecked out.
Yeah.
It is a big deal. And that's why you get people from other, I mean, Todd Gilliland was there, and last year Gilliland ran really well, and I want to finish like third or fourth. This year they got there, and there were some rule changes that took place during the weekend, and the Gillilands did not agree with it, so they actually packed up and went home rather than even trying to make the race.
Got it. Now, let's move on to NASCAR again, or back to NASCAR. Zach, we're going to Dover this weekend. You and I will be there. Who we got NASCAR. Going to Victory Lane?
Nice call. Who I have winning. Starting with the Xfinity Series, I have Elliott Sadler getting a win. I know that's pretty wild because it's been a long time since he's won. But
2 years.
Him and his teammate Allgaier had that tremendous battle. We've had a lot of great finishes this year, but that was definitely one of my favorites, having those two teammates beat and bang in that last corner for the win. I think he's going to be number one this weekend. And going to the Cup, I'm going to go with a guy who beat and banged about everything except the Victory Lane Trophy. That's Kyle Larson. he's done tremendously well all season, and definitely at Dover in the past. We talked about how many races he's almost won there. So I think he's going to get that first win there this weekend. So Elliott Sadler and Kyle Larson.
Neff?
Wow, as much as I feel like Carl Long has a shot at getting it done this weekend, I'm going to go a little bit of ways from them, and I'm going to go with somebody that's almost running in their backyard up there. We're going to go with Ryan Preece in 18. Preece did really well in the Xfinity race, didn't get a lot of pub, but had a pretty strong run in the Xfinity race on the Roval, which thumbs up to Chase Briscoe, by the way, Millbridge Speedway alumnus. We always like to see when our Millbridge guys do good. Congrats on the win. And then at the Cup side, I think you're going to see Kevin Harvick reestablish once again his dominance in the sport, and he is going to be the first one to advance to the third round in the Cup playoffs.
Got it. Now, the Xfinity race is interesting because it is the end of the first round. Justin Allgaier needs a good run. I'm not going to go with him. I'm not going to go with him to win. I'm actually going to go Daniel Hemric, who probably should have won this past weekend, except for a late, kind of like a Jimmy Johnson move, except he didn't spin.
Stepped on his Johnson.
As you were going to use for the pace laps or
that. That was going to be my greatest headlight ever, and our editorial staff shot it down on me.
Well, I think Hemric will go to Victory Lane. In Cup, I'm going to go out on a limb. I think the big three are obviously going to be, you know, very noteworthy. They're going to be in contention for the win, probably the most laps. But I'm going to go Jimmy Johnson. I haven't picked him all year to win a race, so I think he keeps that streak alive this weekend at Dover.
I would love to see him Dover and win Martinsville and win Homestead and just to emphasize what a stupid move that was to wreck out in Charlotte.
Yeah, he'll be thrilled but unbelievably disappointed. It's going to be a weird concoction of emotion.
Something similar happened to Dale Jr. in 2014. He got eliminated in the round of 12, it would have been, and then he won Martinsville.
Then won Martinsville, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you never know. So he would have been to...
Absolutely, and that's right up there with it. I still, one of these days, if I ever get to sit down and do an interview with Junior, I want to ask him about 2004, because he wrecked out at Atlanta, made a bonsai move on Carl Edwards that ended up knocking him out of the race. And had he just been patient, he was going to win that race. He had the best car that day. And based on the math of it all, he would have won the championship and instead came in fourth or fifth, whatever he ended up in the final standings that year. But I've always wanted to ask him, in hindsight, what he thinks that decision ultimately played out into the rest of his career. Because if he doesn't make the dumb move and wins the championship, I think we speak of Dale Jr. in an entirely different light than we do now.
Yeah, that's true. So I think it's going to be a good week of racing. Hopefully Dover needs it. It's had a couple good races in the past five or so. But Neff, it's official. Front Stretch is using Patreon now. I know your tech talk will be on there from now on. We might give a podcast here or there, but... Hey, throw us some money. We'll appreciate it. We'll give you some good content.
We will hook you up. And I apologize. Tony Gibson was our tech talk guy that was supposed to lead us off this week. And he and I played phone tag a bunch. I'm still going to get him on and do kind of a retrospect of how the whole weekend at Charlotte went. And then this week we got Justin Alexander will be our tech talk guy. So we'll talk about preparing for the final seven races of the year, knowing that you're not running for a championship anymore, but you're still trying to. And I wanted to ask, Zach, I know you mentioned something earlier about these guys know they're not going to finish better than 12th. Have they changed that rule? Because I thought you could still finish fifth as long as you were in the playoffs.
Not sure about that. I know that in the past that's been a rule. Perhaps I can, you know, pull up the points and see what the point gaps are right now. But yeah, from my understanding,
well, they reset after each round. So
yeah, but I think that go out drop back into the 2000s or whatever.
Yeah, you're right.
So
now,
in theory, you can finish fifth, even so Jimmy Johnson could end up fifth if he wins. For Martinsville at Homestead.
Well, that's not what I'm looking at right now. I'm looking at the top four who eliminated, they're at 2,000.
Right.
And the guy 17th on back, they're still out there. Like, Newman's 17th, and he has 600 points.
Right, right.
Yeah. But I'm saying if you're 16th now, you could still get to 5th,
right.
I think.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yep. So, a little confusion there, but I do believe Neff's right. That's how they've used it in the past, unless there's a rule change that none of us have heard of. Maybe Zach's heard of it.
We'll verify that. Give me, fill for about another 30 seconds, and I will pull up last year's Homestead stats, and then we'll know.
All right, cool. So, Zach, we'll be going to Dover this weekend. I'm pretty excited about that. So, I don't know.
I've never been to Dover. I am dying to go there.
Yeah, man, you got to get a picture of big old Miles. That thing's bigger than you think.
Oh, yeah. It's a hell of a track. I know I enjoy my time there. It's pretty badass. I mean, if you've been to Bristol, I mean, Dover's kind of a bigger version of that with the high concrete banks. And I know the bridge, as a photographer, that's an awesome place. And for fans, I think Dover gives them a lot of opportunities to be up close to the cars. So it's going to be a really exciting weekend, exciting for Xfinity and obviously for Cup on Sunday.
Okay, so to clarify, last year, Chase Elliott ended up in the fifth position, and his points were 2,377.
Yeah, so they make
when they drop you out of a round, you go back into the 2000s with the other drivers that are in the final 16.
Yeah.
So you're ahead of 17th on back, but you can finish as high as fifth. So those guys that got knocked out or have at least still got something to run for. So
exactly.
When we talk to Justin Alexander in Tech Talk this week, we'll ask him about running for fifth now instead of first.
Got it. Well,
I'm glad that's a thing because, as you said, it gives these guys something to race for the remainder of the year. So that's a good rule.
Yeah, and so this podcast has been long as hell. Make sure to follow Front Stretch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Zach took a lot of cool pictures for us this weekend at Charlotte, the Roval. Zach doesn't use Twitter. Neff's banned from Twitter, as we found out last week. But you can follow me at Dustin Alminos. That wraps up this week's edition of the Front Stretch podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Until next week's show, where we review Dover and preview Talladega, we out.
Go Cubs, go!
Bye.